You're listening to All Politics is Local in Massachusetts on New England's News and Talk Radio, 830 WCRN. Once again, here's your hosts, John Featherston and Terry Hendricks.
With 50,000 watts of political talk all across New England, you're tuned to WCRN 830, All Politics is Local. He's Terry Hendricks. I'm John Featherston. Good morning, New England. We've got two exciting guests in the studio. They're the authors of Easy Money and the Great Ponzi Scheme, John Agustinelli and Chris Michaud. So, guys, tell us, what's the true cause of the real estate bubble crash?
Well, what we were hearing, really part of the impetus for writing this book, was that what John and I were seeing in the field, we collectively sold about 300 properties. We worked for the largest REO foreclosure servicer in the country, and we both sat on their broker council. So out of 6,000 brokers across the country, we were one each of 12 that served there. And what we were seeing, not just in our markets, but across the country through our collaboration with our peers, was that what politicians were saying, what the media was saying, was entirely different than what we were all seeing. And so our research over the past 3 years has, we've discovered that these are the things that really caused the real estate bubble. Poor government policy, the Community Reinvestment Act, Federal Reserve rate manipulation, rating agencies themselves, mark-to-market accounting, which led to liquidity issues, the real estate industrial complex, of which John and I are part, loose lending standards pushed by HUD, and the financially irresponsible borrowers. Nobody talks about all of those. And they all varied to different degrees as to what, you know, how much they impacted the cause, but they were all involved. And that's what we discovered. It was a much bigger thing than we initially thought. And certainly it was much more complex than what the media and the administration was promoting.
Well, it seems to me that from, you know, what I remember, the administration was pretty much blaming everybody but the government. And of the agencies and things I just heard you mention, it sounds like it's almost all the government. Of course, I guess some greed. I know one of the things that, you know, somebody would go, you know, get a mortgage, and a huge mortgage, and they'd literally say, I can't afford it. And, you know, the broker or whatever would say, well, don't worry, if you can't afford it, you can sell it and make $50,000 in a year. You know, it sounds like easy money in every way.
And there's no doubt that that's exactly what took place. But in addition, and I think people don't understand that we often hear about regulation or lack of regulation as being one of the primary factors that led to the banks recklessly lending money. And no doubt that they played their role. However, I don't think most people understand that HUD is the mission regulator of Fannie and Freddie. And I also don't believe that the average person understands that HUD continued to push affordable housing goals on Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie were required in the mid-90s to make sure that 40% of their loans were to low to moderate income borrowers. And by 2006, that was pushed all the way up to 56% of the loans they made had to be to low to moderate income borrowers. And we don't hear that talked of.
56%. So, and, you know, typically there's going to be a higher risk of mortgage. And when they go, they're going to go fast. I just don't understand the logic of it. Is the American dream broken, guys?
Oh, that's very interesting. We actually talk about the American dream in our book, the very first chapter, as we talk about how it's morphed over the years. That now everybody not just believes that owning a home is the American dream, which really isn't how the American dream started, the actual right to own property and to have freedom of choice of things is how the country was founded. But to address, I just want to touch on this low to moderate income housing thing, because if you listen to us sometimes, you might think that we're anti low to moderate income housing. That is, could be further from the truth. That's, we are pro housing, but we are not pro housing at any cost. And that's really what happened. And just last year, I have a very dear friend, and John knows him too, and he's been in the mortgage business for 25 years. Now, with all this new tight credit box, this guy himself personally last summer loaned three FHA loans. All three of them had debt-to-income ratios of 57% with 3% down payments. Now, tell me that makes any sense once you add, let's say, 25% for taxes, and you add, what are you going to eat? How are you going to drive to work?
Electricity.
Yeah. So this makes absolutely zero sense. And that's what we're opposed to. And if you look at industry standards, a 660 credit score, anything less than that is considered subprime. Guess what? FHA is still loaning down to 580 credit scores with 3% down payment. Does that make any sense at all?
No, it doesn't.
That's what we're concerned about.
Well, all right. So if we look at all of these things occurring today, and sounds like it's just deja vu all over again from a few years ago. And what do you expect is going to happen here? And how far are we away from the next disaster where, you know, there are thousands of foreclosures every day? A lot of people's lives are ruined because they, you know, they're going to lose their homes or their condominiums. Condominiums seem to be, they tend to hit the market first around the bad loans and things, I guess, because maybe more of these moderate to low-income people go for condos and homes, but or is that the canary in the mine, so to speak, the condominiums that if you start to see a lot of foreclosures there, is that disaster coming right at you for the larger market?
Well, that's a great question, and we get asked this often. Where are we in the real estate cycle, and how far are we from the peak? And unfortunately, we think that there is more mortgage underwriting standards that can be continued to be loosened. So we think we're above the trend line. We're heading towards the peak, but we still think the peak is at least out until 2020 and potentially as far out as 2024. And opening that credit box is just, and the longer the cycle goes, the harder we will fall.
Yeah.
And I just might add is that if people only read the part about the real estate cycle in our book, they would make much wiser real estate decisions the rest of their life. Because a lot of people don't understand that there is a very definite real estate cycle, and it varies, but pretty much right around an 18-year period with two exceptions, and over the past 100 years. So that's something that could really help people in the future, to help them with real estate. If you want, you know, I know you can't see this. We have this periodic chart here, and it just shows what happens to credit scores. As the credit scores go down, what happens to these down payment loans on the high loan-to-value ratios? It's unbelievable the amount of defaults. As you gentlemen can probably see, the red are what defaulted.
Wow. And that takes up a lot of space.
That's the majority of the page there.
And it's incredible, and we're being pushed along right into the same scenario that we were.
Well, I don't like to think negatively, but let's say the market does crash. What's going to prop it up in the future? I mean, we've already spent all that prop up money. There's nothing. What's going to prop it up?
That's a great question, John, because the Fed has really shot all its bullets. With the interest rates where they are at historic lows, they really don't have much ammunition.
No.
If something were to happen.
Well, I know in some of the Nordic countries, Norway is an example, where the interest rate in a bank deposit is negative 0.2 or 0.3%.
Please don't keep your money in our bank, yeah.
Well, no, actually.
that's the message I hear.
Well, basically, that's in Europe, where they've had some issues with housing. And I know in a lot of places in Europe, you buy a house, you get a 100-year loan.
Yes, that's true.
And you know, so theoretically, you never own your house free and clear.
That's true. They're called intergenerational loans, and they're made in Japan, too. I'm a little bit familiar with them in Japan back as late as the 80s, 30 years ago, mm-hmm. I first heard about those, because the housing cost is so high. But if you think about that, you're never going to have any equity, right?
No.
Right?
Yeah.
And there's a case made by Ed Pinto, a friend of ours at the American Enterprise Institute, and he thinks that we should eliminate 30-year loan to get some sense back into the mortgage market. And you can do that with certain things. I won't go into the details, like buy downs and accelerated payments, that sort of thing.
But go from a 30 to a 20 or a 15?
Or a 15 or 20, sure.
Yeah,
you build up equity quicker, and there's less risk on the loan because the customer has more equity built up.
That does seem to make a lot of sense.
Well, one of the things that you used to hear a lot about is, you know, poor Joe and Mary, they're losing their house, and it's or even worse, they're still struggling to make their payments, but, you know, they're underwater. They have a mortgage for $400,000 on a house worth $250,000. And so I think somebody like that ought to go ahead and, you know, continue to make your mortgage payment, not walk away. But in America, you can do that. A lot of countries, I think, you know, Australia is an example. You can never declare bankruptcy like that. It's a whole different situation where you can't walk away. You owe until it's paid.
That's correct. Our whole message in the book is that the policies that were designed to help low to moderate income people, they were ill-conceived, they were poorly implemented, and they were combined with wishful political thinking. And that cannot bridge the wealth gap of the nation's working poor. It's that kind of thinking that brought us to the great housing recession debacle that wound up in 7 million foreclosures and $19 trillion in lost wealth. And those who were hurt the most were the low to moderate income working families that politicians claimed to help. We actually borrowed our way out of this catastrophe by doubling the national debt. And just so that you know, in 8 years, that account, that's $70,000 per taxpayer. So in a two-person, a two-taxpayer family, that's $140,000. That's what we added to the national debt. Now think about that. We already had a national debt equal to that. We're now on the hook for $150,000 per taxpayer or in a two-income household, a two-taxpayer household. That's $300,000 just to pay the national debt. And unfortunately, the big prime emotional motivator for John and I is we're leaving a debt legacy for our kids because of our irresponsibility.
Hey, we're going to pick up more on this conversation. At the top of the hour, we're going to be joined by members of the Mass GOP to recap the caucuses for tomorrow. But then after that, we're going to pick back up on the conversation with John and Chris, the authors of Money and the Great Ponzi Scheme. You're tuned to All Politics is Local here on WCRN 830. We'll be back.
Oh, you baby, I'm good.